Ceramic Materials Workshop is a proud sponsor of Tales of Red Clay Rambler. Ceramic Materials Workshop is a place online to learn about how materials really work. We've been teaching about glazes at the most prestigious ceramic universities for years, and now our classes are open to everyone around the world online. Class sessions begin every January, April, July, and October 1st. Or try our new self-guided online workshop, The Middle Glazes, the story of mid-temperature glazes, available now. Use the coupon code REDCLAY, all one word, for 25% off The Middle Glazes for a limited time. Find out more and sign up at ceramicmaterialsworkshop.com.
Greetings! I'm Justin Rothschank, here to invite you to join me and 25 other potters from around the country, virtually, for the 9th Annual Michiana Pottery Tour, online version, beginning September 26th. You'll find a list of participating potters, links to all of our web stores, and more information at www.michianapotterytour.com or on our Instagram page.
Welcome to the Tales of a Red Clay Rambler podcast, featuring interviews with culture makers from around the world. This is Ben Carter. I'm going to be your host. If you'd like more information on the show, please visit our website, talesofaredclayrambler.com. Welcome back to episode 339 of the podcast. Thank you guys for tuning in. On today's show, we talk with Sharif Bey about his sculptural work. If you'd like to see examples of his work, you can do that at his website. That's sharifbeyceramics.com. Before we get to that interview, I wanted to do today's Amoco Community Corkboard, which is in support of the Show Us Your Glaze Ceramic Photo Contest. This is co-sponsored by Clay Week and the Ceramic Materials Workshop, which are offering $200 to the winner of the contest towards an online glaze chemistry workshop. To enter the contest, all you have to do is to post an image of your favorite pot with the glaze recipe on that pot in the comments of your post. Make sure to use the hashtags ShowUsYourGlaze and ClayWeek2020 so that we can easily find your submission. This contest is running until midnight at October the 2nd, so make sure to get in your submission as soon as you can. To find out more about Clay Week and how you can participate in the open studio portion of that, you can go to clayweek.org/openstudio. Also wanted to thank some of the folks that have been donating to help support the show. We are listener-supported, so I'd like to thank Rebecca Ramsey, Eileen Kramer, and Shelley Hurt for their recent donations. If you'd like to get involved yourself, you can do so at the website. That's talesofaredclayrambler.com/donate. Without further ado, we'll get on with the interview. That's a nice David McDonald platter you got back there.
As you know, David and I have known each other for a really long time. And when we, I want to say it was about 15 years ago, I collaborated with a local, I was teaching in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And I collaborated kind of with, you know, some joint grant writing with the community center and an art center, and we brought David down and he did a solo show, and you know, we got to spend some time together. He did some lectures here and some demos here, and and he let me pick one out for the show. But, you know, pretty exciting that every time we kind of connected, he ended up giving me a piece, like every single time, like when we were long distance. I get pieces now once in a while, but it's like a housewarming or a birthday or something like that. But I've acquired quite a bit of a David McDonald collection. But what I really want, and it's like what I'm asking for, it's harder to get. But I think it's because he's older, so it's a little bit more challenging. But he has these platters that he used to make that have like, they're almost like bowls. So they have more depth. You know, these are more or less flat, but the dynamic quality of those lines and those patterns with the depth of the bowl is really, really powerful. I don't know. I'm embarrassed to say, I'm not sure I know the difference between a platter and a charger, but I would say maybe it's more like a charger. You know the difference between a platter and a charger?
Well, theoretically, a charger was the plate that went below the plate. And the charger back in the day, basically the charger could be metal and the plate was actually bread. So this is like 1400s back in the day, European chairman of the board style eating where they all sat at a table. But it's interesting because we don't think about the charger as that now because we don't eat the food off of the food. Like we think of bread as bread, not as the surface you would eat off of. So then the charger became just, there's a big plate and then a little plate on top of it.
Well, it's funny you mentioned this because I was, kind of got into this like rabbit hole last night and going on the internet. And I was reading about, it was like 17th century, 18th century foods, in the US and the things that were very common, you know, that are absurd to eat today. And some things, you know, people still eat, but like, obviously, like if people were poor, it's not unusual for people to eat, you know, squirrel and possum and things like that. But, with some, roasted river otter and you know, stuff like that.
You just ate whatever you could get.
And also people didn't throw things away. So this dish, I think it's called scrapple. You heard of scrapple?
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So just take all the leftover whatever and saute it in cornmeal, and there you go. You know, so I guess eating high off the hog is more normalized today, right? Wherefore back then, you know, you ate whatever off the hog you could afford to get thrown your way. Even like even lobster, which I had no idea. You heard the term poor man's lobster, but I read last night that lobster was so cheap that that's what prisoners and slaves used to eat. So eel was the delicacy. So people, they would use lobster to catch eel, to make eel pie. So lobster was just so prevalent that, you know, it did not have that kind of hierarchy associated with it back then. You know, it's just bullshit. You know, the way that trends rise and fall. It's like, you know, 20 years ago, I mean, I had a beard my whole life. 20 years ago, it was like people turn their nose up to beard. Now it's like, looking good, guy. I'm just like, I'm looking the same. Not that I get too many cat calls. I'm just saying.
Yeah, trends change, man. I mean, it's interesting. Even language itself changes. Like anytime I listen back to, I like listening to older interviews. There's this BBC History Hour where they'll take like an event and then they'll tell the story through live interviews. And the interviews are crazy because the people, well, for one, it's a first person accounting, but just the way they speak is so different than the way we speak. Like there's a formality that we don't have.
Well, this is interesting because it certainly dovetails into one of the potentially valuable conversations we might have as it pertains to ceramics, function, design, because, you know, these things rise and fall and things come in and out of vogue and our usefulness and our values. You know, because I was having a conversation with our students yesterday about what does function mean in our contemporary society and what kinds of objects can we, you know, repurpose. So if there's like a green movement, okay, so I'm at a different place in my life, you know, from a domestic standpoint. You know, I often say that, you know, I've been making pots my whole life, but there was a time when, beer cans and potato chip bags were my most useful vessels, right? Right. But as one becomes more domesticated, you know, you can think about how best might I contain bulk oatmeal, you know. But when you're 19, you don't give a shit about bulk oatmeal because it's the last thing. You're not as concerned with your fiber, right? So
sure.
I was having a conversation with with these young college students and talking about how we might kind of intervene into how their lives function and the objects around them, and what kinds of objects might we use to kind of make them more meaningful, So it was an interesting conversation because, as you know, I mean, it's just so predicated on plastic, right? And which is not environmentally friendly, right? So it fascinates me, that could be like, what if there was, instead of condoms coming in these pack, obviously they need to be sterile, but what if there was like a dispensary where you can get condoms like you get bulk oatmeal? You just dispense them to a little container. And it's like, I got my ceramic, three pack here. And just go under the vending machine or whatever, and it just pours out the same way walnuts pour out. You open up the container and you get a large vessel or any number of things that might be part of a young person's landscape, So
it's, I was giving a talk in where was I? I was in Nova Scotia, and we were talking about what's the most important thing to a college kid's life, and hands down it was their phone. Like, it wasn't like we were in an art school talking about art making, but the phone was the thing that they interacted with the most. They learned from it. So there was this sense of intellectual interaction. They were also entertained by it. There's all these sort of functions that our digital devices play that I think is somewhat new in our society.
Well, the criticism I have about that is, I think in many ways, socially, we're marginalizing the visceral. And I think that that's a really, really an issue. It's so hard. Like at one point my niece lived with us, and I remember, sometimes, trying to raise a teenager and deal with different things, she'd storm out to the house and then try to pick a fight with me via text, because it's interesting, because then she can manage the emotional gravity. And she doesn't have to look me in the eye. She doesn't have to feel, the mood of the room, And this was a much more familiar and advantageous playing ground for her. And I just find that fascinating, to where, there's certain kinds of moments, especially intergenerational. And I think that's the other thing that I have a big problem with. And I remember, Sunday morning, you have breakfast, you sit down next to your parents and you watch whatever's on the tube. It's John Wayne and Abbott and Costello or whatever it is, but you're kind of forced to kind of negotiate an intergenerational world, So we're kind of like working to live, because it's kind of like have it your way, right? Because just, and then the algorithms on the internet, they re-inscribe your values, but they're not trying to force you to be global and open to different cultures and viewpoints. If you're a Fox News, person and subscribes to those kinds of values, they're going to continue to send you other kinds of feed that re-inscribe those value systems. So there's something scary to me about that. It's almost like you always have your crew with you. And as somebody, and I think also this is why I feel so grateful to kind of come up in the kind of through Clay and with Clay through those kinds of experience. Because I was 14 years old, and I'm like hanging out with Paul Soldner over the weekend, and watching him fire, and it was a total, we call it a bug out. It's like I'm 14, and there's this guy, and he's showing pictures of him raccooning in bikini underwear, and But there's just this a whole world. I'd never been to California, and he's showing us stuff that's out there, and you know, ceramic scene, everything about it. I remember this video, his daughter's like, it's so funny now because it relates so much to my life. Because he's like, this is Paul Soldner video, it's probably from the 60s. And he's like raccooning in his underwear, and his daughter comes out. She's like, Dad, can I borrow the car? You know, it's just like that like flash of like another identity, right? You know, he's somebody's dad. And there's that regular domestic stuff going on despite, you know, doing your wacky work as Paul Soldner. But I was saying this to say that, like, I feel really fortunate in that, at least back then especially, kind of growing up in the Manchester Craftsman's Guild, you know, we had kids working after school, we had continuing ed, we had these you know, for me, life-changing workshops where people like Val Cushing and you know, Paul Soldner, June Kaniko would come in, you know, for a weekend at a time. And then there was the local ceramics community, mostly college professors, who would gravitate toward that center to be a part of that. So if Val Cushing came to do a demonstration, that meant Kirk Mangus and Eva Kwong drove down, and the Kim and Ify's and Lee Rexroad from Edinburgh drove down, and Don Headman, and, you know, just everybody from that region, Ed Eberly, everybody from that region would come there. And here I am, a 14-year-old kid, you know, one of just a handful of high school kids, basically in the center of this. It's like a spaghetti junction of influences, right? And it was quite powerful. At the time, it was quite perplexing. But saying this to say that this is what adulthood is. It's being challenged by different kinds of identities and value systems and journeys and aesthetics and choices and visual cultures associated with those values and choices. So I feel like in many regards, not just aesthetically and technically, but I feel like as it pertains to being a citizen, I had the optimal introductory ceramic education because it involved. It's literally like this kind of a proverbial village raising a child.
I'm interested in how you, as a young person, learned to communicate through the process of refining skill. So I heard this other interview where you talked about art can either be a noun or it can be a verb. So can you talk about that concept of like the action of making art fulfilling you as a young person and also as an adult?
One of the things that I think that, I mean, obviously the verb of art does many things for us. And we all learn differently, right? And as an art educator, one of the things that I think about is kind of like the silence, the uncomfortable confrontation of being around someone who's so different than you that it's alarming. I mean, that's kind of what xenophobia and racism and sexism is. It's like, I don't know how to coexist with you. And I have to act a damn fool to compensate for that tension. So I say uncomfortable things. I'd rather be on the offensive than the defensive. So I keep you responding to me so I don't have to respond to you. And the reason I'm bringing this up is I believe that making fills a void. I'm the same way. If somebody comes to my house, I might seem gregarious and outgoing, but I'm a person's person. I'm not a people person. I like engaging intimately, but if I had a dinner party, I would be in there chopping carrots and pouring wine the whole time because I prefer to keep busy. And you could talk to me, you know, from the island or whatever, but I have to keep moving because it makes me, that's my comfort zone. And I found that through making, you can create a comfort zone wherever you are. And when I was a kid, you know, I'm in classes and I'd be doodling and doing different things. And when I look back for a while, I thought like, that was not cool. Like, cause I remember like making tea bowls during some of these workshops. I mean, I was just kind of in the, like, so I wasn't like the old lady in the corner with the, you know, the composition notebook that said Don Wrights on the cover of it. And I'm, you know, rigorously taking notes, right, for the Don Wrights workshop. I was like the person who was kind of like, emulating them, or but I was, in other words, the same thing during the continuing ed classes. I'd stay after. Everybody in the room was over 60, you know, and here I am 15 years old. But NPR is on the radio. They're talking about a number of things. But the kind of the studio hum is what kind of builds a certain comfort and confidence where I can, I don't feel like, you know, the other parallel or connection I want to draw, you know, we're talking about, you know, phones and things. It's like driving your babysitter home now, right? And they're not confronted with you. The present company doesn't function the same way. So they're hanging out with their friends, you know? And I compare that to, like, I was talking to a friend about, like, you know, calling a girl when you're, you know, back in the day, you like have to be nice to her parents and, hello, Mrs. Brown, may I please speak to, you know? So we're not confronted with that kind of intense engagement from people who are different than us because we have, you know, the kind of buffer, right? So for me, I'm saying this to say, socially, making was my buffer. So when, you know, the Manchester Craftsman Guild started to kind of push me out and say, okay, why don't you try this pre-college program? Or why don't you go away and do this? And have you considered going to this? So this is how I'm kind of positioned now to go all over the world. I really attribute it to some of the formative experiences I had with getting out of my comfort zone. And, you know, and I used to think about, and I can't lie, like I would have these visions of grandeur because I wanted to be like those people. You know, it's like one day, you know, I'm going to be the new whoever. I don't know who the rock stars then, you know, they had the old rock stars and they of course, they had their place. But like back then, it was like Michael Lucero, Arnie Zimmerman, you know, those were like the hot shots that were really, really, you know, kind of like starting to also push into other territories. Because you know that ceramics can be kind of insular, you know, but like people who are exhibiting in New York and kind of being parts of other kinds of conversations. And of course, we have the magazine covers and the fanfare that goes with it. So, you know, for years, I had these visions of grandeur about wanting to be that when I grow up. You know, it's kind of like a rocker wanting to be, you know, the next Van Halen or who have you, right? But mine was ceramics. And, you know, and over the years, as my professional identity has evolved from this to that and getting a PhD and kind of coming full circle, but yet never letting go of making, you know, I started to have these bigger existential questions about what clay could do for me and what clay could do for humanity, you know, which is much bigger than getting on the cover of Ceramics Monthly or doing, you know, big shot workshops all over the world, you know. So where is the humility in making? And I think that in many ways I found that there is a bridge despite the spaghetti junction. There's a bridge within that spaghetti junction that I didn't consider. So to answer the question about making as verb versus making as noun, you know, the object itself is, you know, is representational of the experience, obviously. But there have been in art education, you know, arguments about product versus process, you know, since forever, right? So what does this do for me? You know, I say sometimes it's like looking, it's like trying to hear a tuning fork. You know, the tuning fork serves a purpose, but you have to find a place where you can hear that tuning fork. So it's not exactly means to an end, you know, finding that silence, and it's not an audio silence, but it's a silence in completeness. It's a science. I mean, to me, it's, you know, some people have yoga, some people have Tai Chi, you know. This is for me, there's certain aspects of process that are like, it's like weeding the garden. You know, there's a certain kind of inner peace that comes out of process. And yeah, you know, the weeded garden serves a purpose, right? But this is to me more important for me than any of that other stuff because, you know, the older you get, the more complex life gets, the more important it is to find ways of tuning out the stressors and the non-essentials and really trying to really zoom in on what is really important, you know? Cause as you know, I mean, the bigger thing is none of this shit really means anything if we can't if we can't really, really find what we need, and it's not material, right?
Can you talk about how you're an art educator that teaches art educators? We know the difference between process and product. Like, we know that the process of making is as important to making the object, the pot, that we may or may not sell down the road. But how do you teach a high school teacher that has to turn in their curriculum to the administrators and prove that they're having XYZ dynamic that the student is learning or educational outcome? Like, how do you put this into K-12 education or even higher education that process is important? Because I feel like sometimes educational administrators, they want to see outcomes. They want to see, you know, testing. They want to know, like, students get this specific thing.
Well, I got a couple of things that I'd like to say on this matter. So now my brain is like racing. I wish I had notes for myself. but the first thing is, as I told my students just yesterday, I said, part as an art educator, for better or for worse, part of your job is to teach people what your job is. The unfortunate thing about art education, if somewhat tragic, is that we've all had an orientation via arts education. And unfortunately, it's been, you know, marginalized and downplayed. And we have people who, so many people outside of art education who think they know what art education is. So principals, parents, you know, you did this for Johnny when he was in fourth grade. Why didn't I get this for Jason when he was in fourth grade? You know, there's this thing that is kind of perpetuated. There's a culture that boxes art education in. And that's why we don't really look at, probably in some instances, curriculum don't allow us to look at products any newer than Frida Kahlo. You know, this has been forever ago, right? And we're still, despite the fact that art has historically been, you know, this force that pushes democracy and continues to impact democracy in the world by asking questions and by challenging the positions of previous generations, art education, it just kind of fall off in the 70s at the latest. So it's really kind of static, right? So first and foremost, as it pertains to what I was saying earlier, we have to be armed to defend and to push back on that narrative. And one of the ways that I say to do that is, I said, you cannot reasonably be charged with inspiring and renewing the spirits of people if you're not able to renew your own spirit and inspire yourself. So this is where art is important to me as a person who can shine as a result of cultivating energy through making, right? That's first and foremost. When I talk to a principal and I share what my vision is, they're immediately like, wow, not only have I never thought of it that way, but look at this guy. He's been doing this for decades and he's on fire, you know, because when I get to talking about it, you know, not only is my lived history, you know, a premise for that narrative, but also as I talk about it, they see that I'm still very passionate about this charge. So that's the first thing. Second thing, you know, a friend of mine, Jorge Lucero, he teaches in the University of Illinois. When he used to teach school, he used to send a permission slip home to parents, you know, and essentially it said, would you like me to make projects for you to put on your refrigerator and, you know, and for you to adore for the year or two that your child is in my program? Or would you like me to challenge your child to engage the world in such a way that ask them to ask important questions of how they function in a global society? So do you want a global citizen or do you want a robot who knows how to pace shit? And how could they not respond by saying, yeah, I want you to challenge my child. I want my child to look at the world differently. I want my child to explore ways of making and ways of engaging meaning from a multiple perspectives. And it's not always going to mean that I'm bringing something home, you know? So, and this is obviously where we get into like also certain hierarchies. They say, you know, we teach the rich and we test the poor, right? So those people who are more progressive programs allow for that kind of qualitative experience. So essentially what I do is I talk to teachers about, and again, there's a certain amount of privilege in this, but I have students who are graduated with their master's 3-4 years ago, and they're still taking mold making upstairs in ceramics, you know, and going to Enseca and having sales over the summer, you know, and going to museums and traveling. And, you know, what I always say to teachers, I say is it's such an exhausting job, especially, I think specifically in the arts, I think it's an exhausting job in general, but I think the arts, because so few people accept the validity of it, you know, and they think that it's not something worthy of investing in. So it's like, damn, if they're giving you a hard time about teaching math and science, they're darn sure not gonna give a second look to art, right? They see it as a pastime. So when I talk to people, or I try to educate people in my program and in other programs too, because I do other kinds of consultant work and workshops and lectures, it's about positioning yourself so you can fight that fight. And also living that life out. So, building alliances and acknowledging the interdisciplinary connections that really is intrinsic to art. So what is your relationship to the librarian and the social studies teacher and the math teacher and the science teacher? So I hope that answered the question. Cause I know you're talking about, you know, the restrictions of, curriculum. And, you know, and also I think that, you know, this is the way that it works, right? So you can conform, but if you know that there's something else out there, my hope is that that's what keeps that fire burning, because there will be spaces where that's possible. You know, maybe it's an art club. Maybe you happen to get a class that has a lower enrollment than usual where you can do something. I teach a course called Reexamining School Art. And basically the premise behind this course is there's a school art, and it's kind of like the prescriptive curriculum that emerged out of circumstances. And now it's been going on for 80 years. So everybody expects these kinds of things to happen in the art classroom. And they're based on the restrictions of class size and time and budget and space and facility. But it's almost like, and then somebody all of a sudden says, okay, I want you to make Thanksgiving dinner in a McDonald's kitchen, right? So it is standardized to facilitate the kind of volume and the kinds of experiences that are kind of institutionalized in those spaces. But what I say is, the thing about it that's interesting, we can complain about not having enough time, we can complain about having too many students, we can complain about not having enough space, but the reason they're standardized is you can move those things in any number of ways. So maybe you can change this curricular force by giving students less time, because it's geared toward a very specific kind of recipe. So anytime you alter any of those things, maybe you give them too much to use. Maybe you give them not enough time. And then you start pushing these boundaries and allowing for something else to transpire. And this is where that space becomes a site of research, which becomes a site of renewal, which becomes a site of interest for everyone. And then it becomes, damn, what's happening in the classroom? It's not your regular, oh, Tuesday hand turkeys anymore, right? Sorry for the long answer.
No, I appreciate that. I want to get into your work, but I have one more question about your work as an art educator. You've served as an editor for a few different journals and on advisory boards. I think the journal that you were the editor, I think 2017, the Journal of Social Theory and Art Education, which these types of journals are about big ideas. You know, this is about educators thinking about their thinking, writing articles, and then trying to disseminate what their research is back out into the community. What do you think the role of a journal like that can be? Like, when does a journal work well and when does it not work well?
This is an interesting dilemma responding to that question at this point. And I don't have any other way of going about responding other than being brutally honest. The reason why I'm doing less and less of that work is that I've kind of come to a place where I, like at one point I wanted to see if I could do that kind of work. You know, like I came to a big research institution and, you know, I had a kind of an, I wasn't the usual suspect for an academic position, more of a maker. I wasn't publishing a lot when I came to Syracuse. So I really wanted to see if I could kind of pull my weight as a real deal scholar. And I started, I mean, I knew there was disparity between theory and practice, you know, but those communities are so isolated from one another that it's kind of a whole nother world, you know? So there are people who are talking about what they used to do in the 1990s and thinking about how it might relate to 2020, you know, and it's like, you're pre-computer, you know, much less pre-TikTok, right? So the validity of what people are talking about, you know, when we have somebody who's 55 or 60 years old, who worked with kids regularly when they were in their 20s, and it just becomes this kind of a culture of navel gazing. And it's something that I've come to have a problem with, and I've become less and less interested in that kind of impact, you know, to be honest. And because Syracuse University has positioned me uniquely as somebody who's in both colleges, like, I feel better about saying the kind of things I'm saying to you and talking about this same kind of things that are important, talking about where the rubber hits the road while demonstrating on the wheel for 50 people. Like, I feel like, you know, for me, I feel like that kind of impact is more, for me personally, is more rewarding than another scholar reading what I have to say about something in a book, or watching me present at a national conference. You know, what I want to talk about very plainly, I want to talk about how art can sustain us, our spirits. I want to talk about how art can connect us and how art can ease us in our transitions. These transitions are significant. We need that. You know, and I've gone through a significant one recently as I'm suddenly not hip and cool to students anymore. As I approach my 50s, you know, everything I say is a dad joke. And it's like, I used to be so cool, you know. But, you know, but I have something. They have this, they call this thing in kind of class management world, it's expert power, you know. So the beauty of being able to do something well that students are interested in many regards, that's what held me there, you know, at the Craftsman's Guild. I certainly didn't have anything else in common with people at the Craftsman's Guild, but, you know, to watch somebody throw things on the wheel and put them together, you know, to watch, Paul Solder stomping on those slabs and, you know, putting them together. And, you know, it was really almost intoxicating. And it was enough to kind of keep me in the game. So, you know, expert power is one of the many ways that we could kind of like bring communities together, people looking at things and seeing things. And that's the beauty of places like Penland and Aramount and, you know, and Anderson Ranch, where people go to these places and they want to see someone do something they're interested in, you know, with a level of mastery, right? So, you know, I'm saying that to say that I have a lot of questions about the role that academia plays. And I have to say, too, that that was one of the conversations that we'd often have at that place, because the Journal of Social Theory was part of like the Social Caucus, which is kind of a, you know, kind of a subset of the national conference. And we gave money to teachers to come to the conference. Like, that was one of the things we did. We raised money for teachers to come to the conference, you know. And then out of respect for us awarding certain teachers monies, you know, they would come to our, you know, our town hall meetings and our spill out groups. And of course they feel isolated. Like, they bust their ass. They don't have time to think about what they're doing 90% of the time, right? Because the job is so overwhelming, you know? And if I'm not going to do that, I want to try to spend as much time saying, this is the elephant in the room, you know? So when I kind of hand a teacher off, a pre-service teacher to a host teacher, and I'm in that kind of mediating that meeting and that connection, I say, I am theory, she is practice. And I want to mediate what this means. I don't want you to let go of what's possible. And I don't want you to stop thinking critically about what you do. So what I'm trying to do is to kind of impress upon them a certain framework for which they can look at this and be realistic, because I don't want them to get fired. I say that too. It's like, if you go in there and you're too radical and you're too visionary, you know, you kind of have to really reconcile the realities of teaching and the culture that teaching has promoted and the associated policies and things that box the possibilities of art education in. But then you have to find a space to kind of push beyond and do something more. And my hope is to kind of help them use the arts, continue to sustain their spirits, such that they'll be brave when they step on the front line. So I am a manifestation of a transformative experience, and this is what I'm coming here to do for this school and for you, kind of clandestinely, right?
And I think you're right that transformation is attractive. Like the math teacher, the English teacher, at least in my high school, they always were sticking their head in the art room because there was something happening there, you know, and that is a valid experience in a K through 12 education to have. I want to go do a deep dive into your work, or at least a couple recent bodies of work. You reference a lot the Nkisi. Can you talk about what that is and what that object means to you?
Well, Nkisi power figures, you know, are West African figures that historically serve multiple purposes from a ritualistic context, you know, and one, the idea of impaling something is a way of, you know, imbuing it with power. It is also said to be, you know, affirming an oath, which kind of I relate to this idea of putting a pin in something, you know, let's put a pin in that and come. It's like, this is my commitment and we're going to continue that conversation. You know, I have to say too that, and this is somewhat of, obviously it's an appropriation because I'm not aware of any authentically made ceramic Nkisis. They're usually made out of wood. They're certainly not, you know, traditionally made, you know, in Syracuse University or Syracuse, New York. So there is a shift in, and there is an appropriation on some level, but there is also an homage to, you know, what that object means. So for my Nkisis, I have some of them that involve clay on clay. I have some that are metal on clay. You know, probably the earliest series involved me kind of thinking about this idea of reclaiming something. I used to make, and I still make, lots of work out of previous work. You know, I've been working in clay since I was 14, so there's a lot of years of information that, you know, that is sharded and that exists in attics and cupboards and gardens and, you know, in basements. And I oftentimes reacquire work that is not intact. And I will break it up and integrate it in a new work. I also have a history of utilizing old student work. And I feel like, and then recently, over the last couple of years, I started to acquire more and more ceramic shards from an old kind of ceramic factory graveyard. We had a Syracuse China was here for over 100 years, and they basically outsourced back to China. After being here, it's kind of ironic. Syracuse China's back in China. But they leveled the factory, and for years after, there would be crates of, you know, kind of unglazed pottery, you know, that which usually goes to hotels and restaurants and hospitals, mugs and cups and such, and plates. And then recently I would kind of start to reclaim the history. I think of it as reclaiming the history, because all these things at some point were in someone else's hands. So I think there's kind of a fitting metaphor associated with taking something, and especially taking something from industry and kind of in some ways repurposing it in a very different way. But getting back to this idea of verb, you know, when I was young, one of the things that I would do obsessively is Sgraffito. You know, I carve images and patterns on works for hours and hours. And I would get a sense of tranquility through that process. Like I couldn't even make a pot without carving it, you know, for about probably 15 years. It was like naked without, you know, me doing something to the surface. So I'd always put an ongo board in or Mishima or do something to it. And And I find that the idea of impaling an object, you know, countless times with carpenter nails or blacksmith nails or ceramic shards, in many ways gives me that same kind of feeling. You know, it's on the banding wheel and I'm just spending hours and hours, you know, altering this surface to create, you know, what I would call a random repetition, which is a form of pattern. It's like just like me carving triangles around the side of a pot. So from a verb perspective, that's how I think about what making that thing means. And over the years, I've used these patterns to suggest other things. Like, so, you know, in the Kisi power figure, it's more of an overall figure, but I've used nails and clay shards to represent hair, beards, pubic hair, feathers, you know, so I've referenced other kinds of things from natural history as well in that work. But it's, to me, I just see it as it's just something I've added to my repertoire by way of you know, this kind of intersecting influence.
Part of the practice of making Nkisi is that is a physical manifestation of the spirit. You know, like that I remember studying about this in a class where they said, like, that's an object, but that is a being. That is a that object has substance in the culture in a way that we often don't think about objects having substance. So can you talk about sort of the metaphysical part of referencing that? Like, do you have any beliefs about objects having a spirit or being able to hold some sense of consciousness in them?
I'm not going to say no to that, but I think that the Robineau vessel at the Everson here, which is, you know, one of the most well-known, you know, vessels of that century, I would say, in the United States. Actually, I live right around the corner from where Robineau hailed. I'm in the same neighborhood as Robineau. There's a street, three streets down called Robineau. It's named after her, ironically. And I didn't even know that when I moved into this neighborhood. But anyway, what is it, like 10,000 hours or something, 1,000? I don't remember. I'm sorry. Garth will probably get at me for not knowing this, because this is like Syracuse ceramics history. But anyway, the idea that much energy is invested in something. And then sometime too, like it's not necessarily that intense, but our presence with an object over time, it does merit intensity. So, you know, I think sometimes when we look at something, we take for granted that. Like, people just look at my carving and say, oh my God, I can't believe that you spent so much time on that. And I said, well, do you feel that way when you look at a, you know, a handwritten letter and you see T's and I's and J's and Y's? Because it's no different, really. It's just like, you know, so this is just a stream of consciousness, right? I got the loop tool and I'm doing this and doing this and doing this. And before you know it, you know, just like sewing or weaving or anything like that. It's just, you know, you invest the time and energy and you see evidence of time and energy. And there's almost, you know, and I think maybe this is a way of answering your question, because I wasn't even sure of how I would respond to it, but there's also there is an energy, you know, it's like reverberation. You know, sometimes when I do have something that I invest in that way, I feel like it, there's this almost, it almost vibrates, you know, and that vibration to me, I mean, and it is, and I think it vibrates in part because of when you're doing something to alter something, there's so much positive and negative, you know, space that it's like almost shaking, right? With intensity, right? But that's through the investment. That's through the time that you spent with that object. So Robineau's doing it very different than the shards, but like when you see these pieces of the shards and nails, there's an energy, and that energy in parts comes from like someone really investing time in it, you know? And I really love making more subtle pots. And I'll go back to that in a heartbeat, because I think it's a different kind of looking. It's a different kind of listening. You know, I love quiet pots, and I think it does something else for me. So there are times where I'll drop that all together and I'll spend a couple of weeks and I'll load up the soda can, you know, and it's almost like it, I can't even describe what it does for me, because it's a different kind of energy. It's a different kind of investment. So it's like, you know, the volume, the expendability, that's really important to me. And I don't always have that in every body of work. It's like, oh, one fell off the table. Okay, whatever. You know, I trimmed this one and it was a sponge in the clay, you know, whatever, you know. And I think that that's a very different kind of energy, but it's almost like that kind of energy and completeness comes out of the process itself and the volume of the work. You know, my wife, she teases me when I shift to make functional pots. It's just like, for the first couple of weeks, it drives her crazy because I'm trying to like get used to the humidity, you know, and it's like, I wake up at four in the morning, check on my spouts, you know. He's like, what the hell are you doing? She calls it the disease, because when it alters me in such a way when I start making functional pots again. But I love it. You know, I just love it's a different rhythm. It's a different intensity. And I think that's what I love about clay in general. But to address your question about, you know, what we invest in an object, you know, it's almost like different kinds of affection, you know. You haven't seen your wife for a month, and you meet her at the airport and you hug her, right? And you hold her. But then you go off to work and you have breakfast with her and you give her a peck. You know, it's a very different kind of sensibility, you know, but it doesn't mean that one is really more than the other. It's a different way of kind of affirming existence.
I wanted to bring into this conversation, if we're talking about points on a spectrum, you know, the functional work is the most visibly quiet and subtle. And then there's the Nkisi work, the figurative work. I kind of think of that as being in the middle. It's very actively engaged. Then on the other end, you have these large scale ceramic necklaces or things that reference adornment or beading. And their scale, the space they take, is the most visually I don't want to say visually impressive, because there's something quiet about them also. They take space, though. Their scale, their monumentality is something that in and of itself is important. So can you talk about that work, like the beaded work, how that came about?
The beaded work came about by a couple of interesting things. So in 2002, I think it was 2001, I was a ceramic studio coordinator at the Manchester Craftsman's Guild. That was kind of like where I started, so I kind of come back full circle. A year after finishing my MFA, and as the coordinator, you know, you're like the visiting artist program, and Don Wrights came in. And I took Don to his hotel, and before that, he and I just had dinner. And it was just the two of us, and we're talking, and it really stuck with me when he said something about, like, I don't make pots. I said, I make statues of pots. And it just, something so simple as that, it just kind of put me in a completely different headspace about my work. So I started thinking about, you know, function and these different kind of rules and conventions. But then this idea of making these like statements that pay homage to the history of something and how it's existed in the world. And that kind of stayed with me. And the next thing is around the same time, someone gave me this illustrated calendar called Women of the African Arc. And there was a picture in the calendar of a young Berber princess from Morocco. And she had on, and they were also common in Sudan, but she had on this giant necklace with these chunks of amber. They were probably the size of a tennis ball. And I can't imagine, she was more than 15 or 16 years old, and she was very petite. And I thought, you know, that was really impactful for me. And then the last thing is, this definitely exists in the United States, but I didn't really get invested in it until I was a student. Many times in my life, I worked at the Academy of Fine Arts and Design in Bratislava. I was there as an exchange student in the 90s. And I went back as a Fulbright scholar in 2003. And And I was really surprised that, you know, I mean, I work and I have a history of working the way that I work, which means, you know, I always work. And the studios just stayed up late with the people who became my friends. So transport design never sleeps. I was impressed that their jewelry and metalsmithing never sleep. And fashion there never slept. So that was my crew. So who am I going to have coffee and chocolate and sardines with? Because that's what we typically ate over here. Funny combination. But I started hanging out a lot in jewelry and learning more about conceptual jewelry. I never thought about jewelry as a conception because it was much more conservative in the school that I went to as an undergrad. And I don't even remember seeing a jewelry program at all in my grad program. So it got me to just thinking about different things. And long story short, as I started to endeavor to make these necklaces, I started to think a lot about natural history, a lot about the history of adornment, but also a lot about something that's also had a huge impact on me and my work is maybe it's because where I am in the generation, because you know lots of my teachers came out of these more formal traditions and so modernism. So this intersection of things. But as it pertains to a process, I found that in many ways, I got to my obsessions. This idea of repetition and how these things all come together. And also this kind of obsessiveness about the care for each object, which I really associate with craft. I remember having this conversation with Chris Staley about craft. And one of the ways that we kind of agreed to define it as we went back and forth, it's like something that's made with care, right? And then there's this other history of craft being about, you know, about coming from the German word that means like power, you know? So in some ways, like kind of, in some ways, when I think about those necklaces, I'm really trying, maybe everybody should try to do this. Maybe this is what I'm trying to do with everything, but like, I'm really trying to blow the roof off of the place when I make these things. Like I want them to be, you know, quietly loud, you know, in a certain sense. Like I don't even know exactly how to describe that, but I think that's why it's a visual manifestation. Like I want it to have power. I want it to have that way of, you know, that repetition to kind of reverberate and the kind of, I really want it to have that kind of power. But also, as I think about these things, I used to think about them in a relationship to the body. And some of the earlier ones that I made, like 2010 and 11, my daughter would model for them. She's like, please, daddy, take the picture and take it off. Because it would be so heavy in the way that it kind of impacts the body. But I really wanted to kind of like invade the body like the young Berber princess. But as I've started to increase more and more in scale, some of them are now, you know, 5 and 6 feet, 7 feet long. You know, I'm really thinking now about like this idea of adorning a celestial being that's not even amongst us. But I do believe that from a making perspective, it kind of, in many ways, you know, everything is nostalgic because I've been doing this for so long. And I love like revisiting my time with people. So sometimes I'll make things that I make, but sometimes I'll go back to making something that a friend of mine was making, you know, in 1992, you know, and it kind of becomes a point of departure for doing something else. But I love alternative firings. I love cold finishes. You know, when we were young, they had this thing and I don't know if it was a thing, but it was just consistent in the circles that I was in. We used to have this, we call it glaze shaming. You know, we used to give people a hard time who weren't like formulating all of their own stuff. It's like, oh God, that's from Duncan. You know, you know, what a cheat, you know, and it's absurd. But, you know, nonetheless, we go through these stages. And the thing that I like about them is that I believe that they're sculpture and that they're really, and my ideas about sculpture, as they've kind of pushed me to reconsider what ceramics can be, I feel really privileged to have come to that realization. It's like sculpture has been what has allowed me to break any perceived rules that box me in as a ceramic artist. So now I literally, and it's also contextually based because I work in so many different spaces. You know, I use anything from, I had a series of work. I was in a kitchen when I was finishing them, and it was paste wax and cumin and turmeric, you know, and that was how I finished. I had another piece. I had some other work that was going in the garage, and next thing you know, I end up with like Bondo and spray paint, and I had some things in my daughter's room with nail polish. Like it just, and then just the repertoire has kind of like evolved uniquely as my kind of transient nature has compelled me to work in all these different spaces. So, one thing I want to also say that, you know, when I first start making these, just kind of like sitting here, I actually have a quilt and some terra cigalata and some clay and a brush right there in the living room. I just make these and hang out with my family and watch TV, and I just pinch all these things. I did the Kohler residency about 6 years ago, and I started slipcasting a lot of things too. And the odd thing is, you know, what I propose to do is like change my palette, also making things that were denser because I start firing the cone 10 as opposed to 04, which lend itself to much more possibilities with things together, like having things that are earth and wood, look different than having these pretty dense cone 10 pieces. But what I became really obsessed with is giving them that really subtle sheen, despite them being high fired objects. Like how can I get that kind of burnished look? And that was something that, despite going a whole different direction, sometimes we are who we are. That this kind of obsessive need to treat every bead like that. You know, I found a way to kind of create that same kind of subtle sheen. But anyway, that's pretty much the nutshell. And the other thing about the way these things evolved, and some of them are now made of glass, is that mixed media and the engineering component. So I started getting excited because it was something so new for me. How does this hang? How can I keep it rigid? You know, what about the weight of this thing? And more new kinds of questions and new kinds of materials started to kind of enter into the equation. So it started out as something I had no idea how I was going to hang or resolve it. You know, it's now, you know, reinforced steel and rubber and using hydraulic, you know, things to kind of bend metal and thread these things, tap, welding.
Well, I wanted to end on somewhat, this seems unrelated, but I promise it's going to relate. You came from a big family. I think you have 12 brothers and sisters. Is that right? Okay. And you're teaching in academia both as an artist and as an art educator, teaching other educators. So when you're in a big family, you have to take space because if you don't, your brothers and sisters will take that space from you. So how do you see your art making practice as you taking space in academia? Because there's something about this beaded, those necklaces specifically, especially when you're photographing yourself wearing them, I keep thinking about like you're physically taking space in the gallery. So can you talk about that in relation to your family history and then also just in the relationship of you being an African-American artist today in this moment? How do you take space through the act of making?
Should have had you send me these questions to me ahead of time. Then.
Yeah, sorry. This is a big question.
It's a whopper. Well, the first thing that comes to mind is I actually wrote an article about this, and I want to say in a way to kind of send like an addendum to something I said earlier about academia. You know, there are journals that are kind of more teacher-friendly journals. Journal of Social Theory isn't one of them, but I also have published in the Journal of Art Education, which is a little bit more between a magazine and a journal. And it's a little bit more specifically geared toward teacher education, and probably more art teachers read it. But I wrote an article about, you know, contested space, and I wrote an article about, I mean, it was the same article addressed the fact that, you know, I didn't have my own room, you know, I didn't have my own space, I didn't have my own stuff, and having an education that talks about significance of objects and how does that work when you're in an existence where things just don't last and things are taken from you and things privacy is almost impossible. But it led to me having a very kind of curated experience. So when I got my college dorm, that was just like the first time I could hang things on the wall in my studio space, and I can you know, trim my bowls and flip them over, and they're just where I left them when I come back after lunch, you know. And so I became kind of obsessed with certain kind of order. But what I think you're saying, though, I could be wrong about you know, the way you're talking about space as it pertains to my identity as an African American, you know, maybe brings forth this question of representation, and maybe one way of thinking about it is like a seat at the table. You know, when you think about what you want to be when you grow up, the other thing that's really, you know, I talk about the names that most people know, you know, like Paul Soldner and Don Wright and, you know, Val Cushing and Ron Myers and Jim Caniego. So these are some of the bigger influences that I think I mentioned. Arnie Zimmerman, whose work was really hot, you know, when I was a young guy in the 90s. You know, the other thing is seeing possibilities from people who come from similar circumstances or similar backgrounds than you. And, you know, and back then, of course, maybe less so now, you know, there were always these kinds of contemporary African-American ceramic exhibitions, you know, and it seemed like there was only like six people of color in clay in the whole world at the time, you know, but it was always, you know, James Watkins and, you know, Yvonne Tucker and James Tanner and Winnie Owens Hart and David McDonald. And, you know, so that to me was a different kind of catalyst, you know. But in many regards, you know, and this is the time for better or for worse, this was the time, visibility meant a 5x7 postcard. Or if somebody picked up your poster out in Sika and put it on the wall, you know. There was no Instagram. So the possibility for someone being recognized and hashtagged from the margins, it's a very different reality, right? So in many regards, that generation, you know, demonstrated possibilities for us, you know, and that's important. But the truth of the matter is, and some people tell their story in a way that it becomes fetished and marketed in a way that I'm a little bit conflicted about. Also, as a Muslim, you know, humility is really important. So, you know, trying to kind of checking yourself and not being this braggadocio person. But by the same token, I say it's conflicted because people need to articulate these stories, you know, because these stories shed light on possibilities. You know, one of my friends gave me a hard time. I mean, I got 3 degrees and I never went to any graduations, you know. And it's just, I didn't want to sit through the ceremony. But when I got my PhD, one of my buddies gave me a hard time because he said, you know, there could be some, you know, African-American kid on scholarship, you know, working in food service back there catering, you know, and he needs to see you walk across that stage. He needs to see that. And, you know, it's kind of funny. I remember, seeing a dual lecture. It was Norm Shulman and Ed Eberle, and I don't know which one did it, but one of them showed their Alfred graduate portfolio, and whoever went next basically went up and said, "That counts for me too." That's the same. I made the same portfolio. So with regards to a lot of those things that need to be said, you know, that's not my brand, you know. And I don't represent that struggle in that way, you know. And Roberto Lugo says all that stuff. I don't need to say that, you know. And he says it very well, you know. So I could say, oh, that counts for me too. You know, I came up poor and I've seen people die and I've seen this poverty and clay saved my life, you know. And I'm not trying to trivialize that in any way, you know. But I have interest in kind of telling a different story. And it serves a very different purpose, but there are certainly, you know, connections. But I'm also very cautious of what people take away, because sometimes when we talk about places that people have never known, have never been, we don't really have the same starting point where we begin and where we go. So when I'm in those spaces, I'm certainly compelled to represent something beyond that which everyone else is representing. And as a result, I'm also charged with a different or an additional responsibility. I taught at Penn State as an art teacher trainer. I had 25 middle class, upper middle class white women as my students. I taught at Winston-Salem State in North Carolina. I had 20, 25 mostly working class African-American women, both from a similarly limited worldview. You know, in many regards, my charge was the same. Now, of course, I represent something different in those two spaces, but my charge was to wake up and inspire and to open minds for possibilities.
Well, I want to thank you for coming on the show and talking about your work. Can you leave either your website or social media so people could get in touch with you to talk more about any of the ideas we've discussed?
My website is sharifbayceramics.com. And I think my Instagram is just Sharif Ceramics. And thanks for having me. This has been a pleasure, and I really appreciate your show.
I'd like to thank Sharif for taking the time to do this interview. It was nice to chat with him about his work. I'd also like to thank today's sponsors. That is the Ceramic Materials Workshop. They are offering online ceramic workshops starting on October the 1st, as well as an ongoing self-guided workshop titled The Middle Glazes. If you'd like 25% off of that online course, you can get that by using the offer code REDCLAY when you sign up. You can find out more about that at ceramicmaterialsworkshop.com. I'd also like to thank our second sponsor, the Michiana Pottery Tour, which is hosting their 9th annual tour happening all online this year, starting on September the 26th. If you'd like to see a list of the participating potters or find out more about the tour, you can check them out at MichianaPotteryTour.com. I'll be back next week with another episode. Thank you guys for tuning in. If you'd like more information on the artists on the show, or if you'd like more information about the workshops and events that I'll be having in the next couple months, you can follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook under Carter Pottery. Another great way to support the show is to leave me a comment on iTunes. To do that, search Tales of a Red Clay Rambler under iTunes Podcasts, and you'll find a page that's linked to our show. Thank you guys for the support.